Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
You start off by every lesson, you'll do a bit of hovering practice, and it takes quite a while for it to click into place. I did manage a good hover on my first ever trial lesson, but after that, I don't know, it did take a little while because it's just muscle memory. You've got to get your muscles used to that particular combination of inputs that you need, and how each time you move any of those controls, you have to then adjust all the others.
Extended, your aerospace radio station.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Rachel Ramsey is a UK qualified private pilot with licenses to fly helicopters, small planes, and motor gliders. Rachel has a fabulous blog, and I came across some of her flights on social media and decided that I needed to find out a little bit more about multi-license flying, writing for a blog and an aviation publication, and what does it take to fly down the River Thames in central London. So, Rachel, welcome to Extended.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. I've been fascinated by your predominantly social media journey and just seeing some of the posts you made from the places you've visited, and I want to come back and ask you a little bit more about that in a moment. But where does aviation originate from for you? Where did it come into your life?
Actually, way back when I was little, my dad was interested in it. He didn't actually fly himself, but he had Microsoft Flight Simulator and model aircraft, and I was always very interested in watching him doing those. And then when I was about 14, our neighbour, who was a test pilot in the RAF, who had a share in a Cessna 172, took me and my dad flying one day, and we flew from Boscombe down, and he flew us over Stonehenge. Wow. And I was just completely wowed by the whole experience. I mean, couldn't believe how tiny Stonehenge was from the air. And I just thought to myself that I would love to do this one day. I never really imagined that I would. And then, of course, I was also always really interested in all those programs about chopper coppers and air ambulances, and also Annika Rice on Treasure Hunt. And then fast forward a few years, I was at university going around the Freshers' Fair, and I saw a stand for the Oxford University Gliding Club. And I thought, that sounds like a nice, cheap way of learning to fly. So I just went for it. I signed up, went on the initial kind of trial day, and immediately I was hooked. I did this, I think I did one or two or maybe even three winch launches. And I don't know if you have ever seen or a winch launch or know what one is like.
Yeah, I've been on one once.
So you'll know that it's a very steep climb, and it's very fast. It's very exhilarating. And I was just amazed by it. And from then on, I was kind of going down to the airfield on a very arduous bus journey to get to the airfield once a week when I should have been doing my essays and learning to fly.
Now some say gliding is actually harder than powered flight. Do you think that, you know, looking back, that experience was really useful to the flying you do today?
Absolutely. I think that all pilots of powered aircraft should do a bit of gliding. I think it's a very good way of learning the basics of flying. But it's also It gets you more attuned to the sky, being able to read the sky. So you're aware of thermals and how to spot thermals and things like that. But also you only get one go at the landing. So it forces you to really, you know,
get it right.
Yeah, that's it. And then, then when it comes to flying something with an engine, when you're doing your practice forced landing, so emergency procedures, if you've done a bit of gliding, then you're already used to handling an airplane that doesn't have an engine. Obviously, the sink rate is quite a lot higher because gliders have much longer wings and they don't have a heavy engine weighing them down. But the principles are the same. And, you know, I think that's why, for example, one of the most famous emergency landings is Captain Sully with his aircraft on the River Hudson. And he was a glider pilot. You know, he knew instinctively he wasn't going to make it to that airport. And it's just that sort of mindset, you know, you're used to not landing on an airfield. You're used to having only one shot at the landing. I think it can offer a lot of valuable experience to any kind of pilot, really.
Okay. Now, I came across you on social media flying helicopters, which in some ways frightens the life out of me, but in other ways, I'm totally intrigued. What came first? Was it fixed wing or rotary wing?
Well, the gliding came first, and I kind of worked my way up from there, really, as my budget got a bit more generous. So I started off in the gliders, then I moved on to motor gliders, which is basically a glider with an engine. So that was a good way of getting into the single engine piston world. And then from there, I moved on to PA-28s and 172s, that kind of thing, and then onto helicopters. And that's quite a different kettle of fish.
What a journey. Let me take you back to your fixed wing training then. A question I was going to ask you then is, whilst most of us know motor gliders, they don't seem that common in the UK. Is that right? I mean, I always think of motor gliders being something we see in Germany.
Yeah, certainly.
Somewhere like that.
Certainly, they are probably more common in Germany, for example. There are a few of them around in the UK. Mainly, they are belonging to gliding clubs. So a gliding club will probably have a motor glider in order to speed up teaching certain exercises, just because the whole gliding setup is quite time consuming because the number of people you need in order to make a gliding operation run. You need someone for the winch launch and, you know, someone to operate the car that's connecting the cables and all this kind of thing. So it's quite labor intensive. And also you often will just get 5 minutes in the air. So there are some exercises in the gliding world that are just easier and quicker to teach on a motor glider. So a lot of gliding clubs will have a motor glider as well. But they're actually a really affordable way of getting into flying. And that's how I got into power flying, was on a motor glider. And, you know, a TMG license certainly used to be quite a bit cheaper to get than a full SEP license. So if you learn on a motor glider, it's cheaper hourly rate. And then it's not for you only need sort of a couple of hours of differences training to then convert onto full single engine piston.
Okay, so tell me about your fixed wing single engine piston training. How did you find that transition into what is probably a much more regimented training program, a bit more fixed, a bit more demanding? How did that unfold for you?
Yeah, it was definitely more demanding. I guess the things that mainly took me by surprise were the RT, so radio telephony, talking on an aircraft radio. That was something that, as a glider pilot, I hadn't really done very much of, because I'd mostly just done around the airfield and I hadn't really done any long distance gliding flights or anything, so I hadn't really thought too much about the radio. So that was the biggest thing. Generally, it gives you a lot more freedom. You can take off from somewhere and you can go and land somewhere for lunch and then come back. Whereas obviously in a glider, once you're up, the aim is to stay up for as long as possible. And that kind of involves circling around a lot of thermals to maintain your altitude. which I just didn't particularly enjoy. So I was quite happy to move on to something with an engine.
Yeah, and what was the whole training experience like?
Yeah, I had no problems at all with that. There was quite a bit of ground school, so a few exams, 9 exams, in fact. Plus, obviously, you do the qualifying cross country, which is a, I can't remember how many miles it is. There's 100 nautical miles.
That's how far I found it. It was a very stressful time, I must say.
Landing at 2 other airfields.
That's right. Yeah.
So, and 10 hours of solo flight, which was an interesting experience as well. But it was all really positive. I really enjoyed it. In fact, I loved my training, and that's why I've kind of kept doing more and more training on other things, you know, because I just enjoyed that process so much.
Okay, and what happened when you got your license? I mean, I've read a lot of your blog entries, so I've seen some of those journeys, but I think it's fair to say you were quite adventurous.
Yeah, obviously I've done the usual kind of Latuke trip that every pilot does when they get their license. I've also been involved in bringing motor gliders back from Germany, so those are quite long flights.
Yeah, saw that. I was quite fascinated by that, actually, Rachel, on the basis that I think, as you mentioned, when you wrote your blog about that, it's a one-way flight.
Yes.
Back.
Yes.
Because you're going to pick up an aircraft. Yeah. Was that a little bit daunting, flying in foreign airspace as a relatively newly minted pilot?
Yeah, it was, but I had a commercial pilot with me, commercial pilot and instructor, so I didn't do it on my own. But it was a really useful experience. And something it really teaches you is that nothing goes to plan on a long flight like that. There's always going to be something, whether it's the weather, usually the weather, or we had battery issues with one of them. So we ended up having to switch everything off. We couldn't use the transponder. So we weren't allowed in certain airspace because transponder was mandatory. We ended up having to do a weather divert into Flanders International Airport. Just sounds bigger and than it actually was, but there's been quite a few things like that, but it was a real adventure for sure.
Where did you do most of your flying from then? Was it wasn't from the Cotswolds as it is now, where you were flying?
I learnt from at Wellesbourne.
Okay.
At Stratford-on-Avon.
We mentioned some of your flyaways and some of your adventures. I'm lucky enough to say you've been down to Compton Abbas.
Yes.
What other sort of places did you go to? I mean, we often hear from Americans, you know, the $100 hamburger story and that sort of thing. You, to me, exhibit that, but from this side of the pond, as it were. You know, you made lots of flyaways to places. Do any stand out for you?
Well, I'm a member of Take Flight Aviation, which is a fantastic fixed wing flying club, probably the best in the country, I would say. Not that I'm biased or anything.
No, it's okay. It's good. Let's give them a shout out.
Yeah, absolutely. Takeflightaviation.co.uk, I think, is their website.
All right.
And they have a really busy program of flyouts each year. So we've been to all sorts of different places. We've flown to the Netherlands and did some island hopping. We've done each year, the kind of main event on the Take Flight calendar is the Shuttleworth Flying Proms at Old Warden, which is a really lovely event. We all go and take a load of aircraft, land there take a picnic and just listen to music and watch the air displays, stay the night and then fly back the next day. So that's always lovely.
Yeah.
Where else have we been? We've been to lots of kind of local airfields for an evening or something like that. So a nice evening fly out or trying to think where else we've been. Latuke, of course. Kitty Hawk, which was a new one for me relatively recently, down towards Goodwood sort of direction.
And do any of these daunt you at all? Because you come across to me as quite confident in both your flying abilities, but I certainly, when I was training, I was quite daunted by some of the particularly British airspace constrictions and things like that. you don't come across that way. You come across quite confidently in your flying capabilities
no.
and your trips, and there's always a smile and a photo.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I was hugely confident, no. I'm very aware that one false move could mean serious yeah. trouble. I've got enough yeah. experience to know of all the different things that can go wrong. Even when you do a lot of planning beforehand, you know, things do go wrong, and I would never be complacent about that. I think complacency kills.
Yeah.
If I, in my photographs, obviously that's when I've landed and I'm all smiley and everything, but just to give you an indication,
right.
I don't post anything on social media until I'm back from a place. So I wouldn't okay. post anything while I was there, but still had the flight to come back, because I just think,
that's
you know,
I'm
worried that that's going to be the last picture anyone sees of me. You know, I mean, that has been known to happen, you know, people live streaming from the cockpit and then minutes later they go missing. And, you know, I don't want to jinx it by doing anything like that. So.
And in fact, to be fair, I think recently you posted that you had to divert or avoid a particular place because of weather. And I think, you know, it was your picture back at
was that
back down? But
yeah, exactly. That was actually I was flying. I had a pilot friend with me in the right hand seat, and we were going to go for lunch to Abergavenny. And it was lovely and sunny and warm, and I took off, and literally we were just met with solid haze, you know, that you couldn't even see through. It was, you know, it was IFR conditions. And so just made the decision there and then just go straight back in the circuit and land again. And yeah, smiley picture of me from the ground. But I wanted to make the point that sometimes the best thing to do is just to go back. And you know, that there's, especially if you've got a lunch destination in mind and you've got a table booked and everything, and you think, oh, it'll probably be okay. I know that there are people flying up in Shropshire at the moment, so it's clearer elsewhere. But the last thing you want is to be enveloped in weather like that. And it's better to be safe than sorry. And there'll be another nice day that we can go to Abergavenny when there's not solid haze.
Yeah, of course. I think they called it get there right when I was flying in America.
Exactly.
You know, get there at all costs and can be quite dangerous. So so you've been flying for about 10 years now?
2007 I started.
2007, okay, a bit longer. and you made a transition to rotary wing. Why did you do that? Was it this continual drive to keep going and doing something different?
That was part of it.
Helicopters,
but I've always wanted to fly helicopters. That I think to me they are the ultimate form of flying. And as I said earlier, I was always into those chopper copper programs and air ambulances and treasure hunt with Annika Rice. And so helicopters have always been the ultimate for me. And also when I was about 12, we went on holiday to the Scilly Isles, and that was on a commercial helicopter. You know, I was just amazed at what they can do that airplanes can't. And I just think they're so cool. I mean, you just can't argue with that.
a lot of fixed wing pilots think differently.
That's just because they're jealous that they can't fly them.
Yeah, well, listen, I used to be a drummer in my younger days, so I can do different things with different arms, but just reading your explanation of the collective and cyclic, I was trying to do it, but it just wouldn't come to me. So how did you make that transition? How did that go for you?
Yeah, it's a bit like patting your head and rubbing your tummy, isn't it? There's no two ways about it. It's a different kettle of fish from flying an airplane. It's an inherently unstable machine, so you have to fly it 100% of the time, whereas in an airplane you can take your hands off the controls and it just flies itself. If you do that in a helicopter, you're going to spiral out of control pretty quickly. So you've always got your hands on the controls. And I mean, you start off by every lesson, you'll do a bit of hovering practice, and it takes quite a while for it to click into place. I did manage a good hover on my first ever trial lesson, But after that, I don't know, it did take a little while, because it's just muscle memory. You've got to get your muscles used to that particular combination of inputs that you need, and how each time you move any of those controls, you have to then adjust all the others. So it's so you'll start off by learning just the pedals, and the instructor will have the cyclic and collective, then you'll do just the collective, then you'll do just the cyclic, and then you'll get combinations of those, and then eventually you'll have all three of them put together.
And what do they all do, Rachel?
So the collective is up and down. That's with your left hand. The pedals are controlling the yaw, so they're basically controlling the tail rotor. So when you're hover taxiing around, you're using the pedals, but in the air you don't use them so much. And then the cyclic is controlling your direction. And of course, unlike with an airplane where you can kind of go forward and you can turn to one side or the other, you can go any direction at all with a helicopter. So you're going forwards, but you can also go sideways and backwards, and you know, it's just incredibly maneuverable.
And which one of these gives me power?
That's the collective. Yeah, good point. So the collective has the throttle on the end, and they're linked.
Okay, on the end.
Yeah.
Another one.
So there's essentially four, but because there's a governor and a correlator which sort of matches the control input to the amount of power you need. So you don't have to do that manually. Although some older helicopters, like the Bell 47, you do have to do that manually. So that's just, even more to think about.
So what did you start flying? What did you start learning to fly rotary on?
I learnt in an R22, which is what I think a lot of people learn in. It's a little bit cheaper per hour than the R44, which is the four-seat version of the 22. So I did what a lot of people do, and I learnt on the 22 and then immediately did a conversion onto the 44. And helicopters are not like fixed wing or single engine piston fixed wing, because you need a type rating per type. So it's a different type rating to fly the R22 from the R44, even though they're very similar machines, and they're obviously the same manufacturer, everything's in the same place. You still need a specific type rating for the 44.
Right. Okay. And how long did that take to get a type rating? How does that, is that a long process?
The type rating's only 5 hours. But when it comes to the whole PPLH, that took me a year. And then, so I finished in, I think, May 2018. And then I just did the R44 type rating over the summer, which was nice.
Oh, okay. And how good did it feel to get that?
Oh, absolutely amazing. I mean, it's the biggest achievement of my life. it's the achievement that I'm proudest of, for sure.
Did you know that the RP-3 rocket projectile, used to great effect by Hawker Typhoons in the tank-busting ground attack role, was originally conceived as an air-to-air weapon to attack Luftwaffe bomber streams? Did you also know that in the 1950s, an indigenous light aircraft built in the Philippines was skinned with woven bamboo matting? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal, print and digital, that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
And was there any benefit of doing the fixed wing, your single engine piston, and transition to the helicopter in terms of things like ground school and things like that?
In terms of ground school, there's a lot of stuff in the heli world that isn't covered in the fixed wing world. But there is some, there is a degree of overlap, but actually of 9 exams, you still have to do, I think, 5 of them again. So there's 5 that are heli specific, even though some of them, I can't remember which subjects it is now, but there was one where you'd really think, I think it was navigation, you'd really think that would be the same. But yes, it's, you've got to do 5 exams again. But in terms of things like airmanship, general airmanship, being comfortable in the air, talking on the radio, navigating, those are all skills that you can carry over, and that does free up a bit of mental capacity at the beginning when you really do need all the mental capacity you can get.
I mean, it just frightens the life out of me, just the thought of trying to coordinate 4 different things. That's just me. But when you when you get your rotary license, it opens up a different world, doesn't it?
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, you can land anywhere pretty much as long as you've got permission of the landowner. So if you had a garden, a friend with a garden that was big enough, you could land in your friend's garden. You can land at nice hotels, pubs, so many different places. And when you're used to being in the fixed wing world and you kind of run through the possibilities of where to go for lunch, for example, it's quite limited. But so many hotels have helipads and they're very welcoming, and you know, you can just land at a nice hotel and have a spot of lunch and then
Well, this is where I came across you on Twitter, seeing you outside, I think, a hotel in the helicopter, big smile. I just thought, this is what GA is all about. This is it. What's it take to do one of those flights? What sort of permissions do you need? And how does it work, particularly locally on the, is it called a helipad?
Yeah.
Is it the helipad in the hotel? Yeah. Somewhere like that. I know you were recently at the Peak Hotel near Bath. I mean, how does one go about a flight like that?
It's pretty straightforward. You just basically phone the hotel, say, can we come in? And most of the time they'll say, yeah, sure. And we'll, you know, they'll email you the details of where the helipad is. And, you know, sometimes you might have particular procedures to bear in mind just in terms of, this field might have horses in, so just avoid overflying this field, for example, or watch out for the power lines in on the southern boundary or whatever it might be. But that's all the permission you need, really, obviously.
And do you scout them or anything like that beforehand? Do you ever?
I basically have a good look on Google Earth and try to get a sense of the topography. You can never really get a proper sense of what the topography is like until you're actually flying over it, which is why we do a little sort of reconnaissance orbit around the site. So, I mean, what might look relatively flat on Google Earth, you might turn up and then you find there's a slope, or, you know, there might be, as one place that I flew into with a friend of mine, they said it's a £30 landing fee to get the owner of the horses to move them out of this field so you can land in. They moved the horses out of the field, but what they didn't tell us was that the whole field was crisscrossed with electric fencing. So that's the sort of thing that you just, you're not going to be able to see that from Google Maps, for example. You've just got to fly around it and take a really good look at what obstacles there are. And there's all sorts of different things to consider. So the length of the grass, you know, what direction's the wind in? Am I going to be able to get out again? Is there any livestock? Are there any cables anywhere? Because cables are one of the leading causes of helicopter accidents. It's loads of different considerations. So we're thinking about all those. We're thinking about, are we going to be landing on a slope? All this kind of thing. Are there dog walkers there who might, you know, not understand that they need to keep out the way and that kind of thing. So there's a lot more to consider than there is landing at an airfield, for sure.
Right. Okay. So that was, you got your helicopter license in, did you say 2019?
2018.
So you had a couple of years before COVID and all sorts of lockdowns ensued. Yeah. What happened then?
At which point, when I got my license?
When the sector sort of closed down, was it literally?
Couldn't fly.
Full stop.
No flying for, I think I went 6 months without flying. And I was sorely missing it by that point, as you can imagine.
You're so polite.
So, but I was surprised. I went straight back into, because my license has to be renewed every year on the helicopters per type. I knew that I had to get back to get that renewed for another year. So I went straight back into that, and I was amazed at how it just came straight back. You know, it was like riding a bike.
Yeah.
All that muscle memory was still there. And it was a relief. I was worried that I wouldn't be able to fly anything anymore after taking that longer break.
Yeah. And just a general question, Rachel, how are you seeing the sector come back after post-COVID?
To be honest, now you wouldn't know any different from my yeah. perspective. I don't know whether a flying school would say the same thing. Obviously, we've got the cost of living crisis now as well. So sure. I guess people are probably a bit more reticent about spending money on something like that. And I'm very yeah. conscious of it is an expensive hobby, for sure. But I'm really careful about how I go about funding my flying and making it okay. more affordable. I always fly with another pilot. So we do one leg each. So that basically halves the cost of the flying immediately. Yeah. And then there's things that you can do, like helping out your flying school if they need to reposition an aircraft. And they'll give you cost price flying or something. You know, there's all these different things that you can do to bring the cost down a bit. And I only ever fly short distances in the helicopter because it's just relatively expensive otherwise. Save longer journeys for fixed wing. To go back to your question, I haven't really noticed now that there's any impact that's been lasting from COVID. I think everyone's just delighted okay. and, you know, keen to do even more and make up for lost time,
yeah,
really.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And over the last few years, I've noticed that you've started to do more journalistic work. How did that come about?
Actually, I think originally I had written an article on my blog about flying the new R-44 Cadet. I think I was the first person from my helicopter school to fly it or something. And I wrote a blog post about it. And I think it was as a result of that Flyer magazine contacted me. I started writing bits and pieces for them about helicopters. And that was 4 years ago. And they even asked me to edit and write a load of content for a whole dedicated helicopter supplement, which was really fun. And it's great because I'm a professional writer. It's not that often that I get to write about things that I actually have as a hobby myself. So I've really relished getting involved with the Flyer team and doing more and more stuff for them.
Yeah, and you recently went off to Aero
Friedrichshafen.
In Germany for them. What was that? What was that to look at? Was it? I don't know much about the event. Can you tell us a bit about what you were doing?
Sure.
There?
Aero Friedrichshafen is a big general aviation trade show, basically. But people who are just general aviation pilots go there. It's like a mecca for GA across Europe. I've been before just as a normal punter a few years ago. And it's great because they have all these huge, huge hangars full of all the latest aircraft, basically, which different manufacturers are there to showcase. So you'll have the big names like Piper and Cirrus, but you'll also have some of the new and innovative manufacturers. So it's a really great destination to go and check out the latest innovations. And the Fly magazine team go every year, and I was really happy that this year they asked me to go as well. And so it's basically we're there to report on what the latest news is for GA world. So for example, the Robin DR400 getting a turbine version. That kind of innovation. I was spent the week basically writing content, filming content, interviewing people. It was great.
And you've also been to Leonardo Yeovil to see the factory there as well. How was that? I've not been there.
It was very exciting. You get there and you feel the sense of aviation history there. You know, it was obviously the home of Westland helicopters, which subsequently were acquired by Augusta and then by Leonardo. But the Westland name has just given birth to so many icons of the helicopter world, you know, so the Wasp and the Scout and the Sea King was made there on license as well, the Lynx, all these amazing machines, and they all came from this site. And it was amazing to visit there. And, you know, you turn up there and there's a Merlin being thrown around overhead, and you know, they showed me around the hangars, and the hangars are full of Lynxes and 101s. And then this amazing helicopter, which was the reason I was there, was the Augusta Westland, or AW-149, which is their new multi-purpose battlefield, which was really exciting to go and see.
Wow. Not flying.
No. Oh, it is flying, but okay. I didn't get to fly in it. It was
you didn't get to see it.
I got to sit in it.
Okay. Oh, the temptation! I bet that felt like you'd love to have a go at that. What other aircraft have you? What other helicopters have you flown then? Did I see you in a Scout or
yes,
a Wasp?
Both of those. I've been really lucky that I've flown quite a lot of different types, often as a result of writing about them for Flyer magazine. I went to Italy to fly a new ultralight turbine helicopter, the Zephyr. I've flown the Westland Scout and Wasp. I did half an hour in each of those, which was an incredible experience.
What were they like? You had a very you did have a very big smile.
Yes.
after that, but tell me what they like to fly, because I mean I grew up watching particularly Wasps bouncing off of aircraft off of ship decks and things like that, and I always think, God, that thing looks so fragile.
Yeah.
How can it take such a heavy pasting? What's it like to fly?
It was actually surprisingly easy.
Right, okay.
Probably easier than the Robinson. And this is the thing, because the Robinsons are quite sort of twitchy, but as you get onto bigger machines, they're just more stable. And so they're actually quite easy to fly. And that's what people are surprised when you say that, but genuinely they are easier to fly than the Robinsons. But you've just got this whole experience of the sound of it, the smell of it. I mean, it smells like this vintage machine. And also just knowing the kind of things that this kind of situations that these machines were built for, you know, this is built for a really tough marine environment, the Wasp, or for battlefield evacuation for the Scout, also gunships. And you've got really cool things on the instrument panel, like flares and rockets and things like that. Can I load this thing up and have a go with these? I mean, that'd be really fun.
And, what was I going to say? That really made me think of something then, and it's gone off my mind. It'll come back. But you're also flying fixed wing at the same time, aren't you? You're flying both rotary and fixed wing. That's not very common. I don't come across many people who do that.
Yeah, I think there's not that many, certainly not that many female pilots who fly both. But yes, I maintain both of them because I do still enjoy fixed wing. I think that helicopters are way cooler and more fun, but I do still enjoy fixed wing flying, and it is a lot more affordable. So there are some things, for example, I've got a client who's a copywriting client based out in Norfolk, and it's a 6-hour round trip by road, or I can just pop to the airfield that's 10 minutes down the road from them, which takes an hour each way. So things like that, it's really useful for. I think of a fixed wing as more a sort of getting from A to B machine, or doing something a bit longer distance, like going down to the Isle of Wight for the day or something like that. Whereas because the helicopter is so expensive and I don't have a rich husband or boyfriend or parents to pay for it all for me, I am funding it all from my own hard work. And basically I have to just really ration how far I go. So I tend to just choose hotels that are about 15 minutes flight time from the airfield. Okay.
So let me ask you about the one that's absolutely fascinated me, and that's flying down the River Thames.
Yes.
Because I'm a London boy, and I used to go to school in Fulham, so I was always seeing helicopters flying up and down the River Thames. But I understand how tricky it is in today's airspace. Can you talk us through how you came about doing that and what's involved in it?
Yeah, sure. Well, flying the London down the Thames was always my goal, I guess, one of my first goals for for when I got my license. And I've got a friend who at the time was a helicopter instructor, Dave Buck, and he always said, when you get your license, we'll do the heli lanes together. And the heli lanes are this network across London, crisscrosses all across London for single engine helicopters, which basically put you on a route that if you had an engine failure, there would be, most of the time, there'd be somewhere for you to land. And obviously the famous one is H4, which runs along the really famous stretch of the Thames with all the landmarks. And obviously that is designed to allow you to ditch into the water if you have an engine failure. Hopefully that will never happen. But it's all very regimented. You know, there's very strict altitude limits. You're talking to Heathrow. There's no way that as a new pilot or even an experienced pilot who hadn't done it before, that you'd be able to do it on your own straight off. You'd need proper training for it. I mean, I wouldn't be able to do it right now on my own. I've done it once with an instructor doing all the, and he was doing all the radio, and I was just concentrating on, okay, I've got to maintain this altitude and, you know, keep a lookout for the traffic and all this sort of stuff. So it's quite involved, but it's just the most breathtaking sight, and it's something you can't do in fixed wing. And yeah, it's one of the things that's a real privilege for helicopter pilots.
Yeah. And have there been any other sort of unusual flights like that that you've done that sort of break the norm?
Yeah, I've landed at a few interesting places. One of them would be the Western Supermare Helicopter Museum, which is a really interesting place to land. It's just an absolute Aladdin's cave of every kind of helicopter you can imagine. Naturally, they have a landing for helicopters to come and visit. I've landed at a place called the Classic Motor Hub, which is a classic car sales room in the Cotswolds. They've got a little helipad out the back, so that was a fun one to go and see.
Cool.
Where else? Yeah, lots of pubs and hotels and things like that.
So what's the plan for Rachel next? Because given what we've said, I can't see you sitting still in your seat.
No.
Just doing what you're doing. So there's got to be something in the pipeline. What is it?
Yeah, well, my ambition is to try every form of flying. So I've got a gyrocopter flight in the planning stages at the moment. What else? I have got, I think I'm going to be doing some paramotoring. What else?
You're quite an adventurer, aren't you?
I'm quite adventurous generally. I wouldn't call myself an adrenaline junkie at all. But I just love flying, and I'd love to try every form of flying at some point. So,
we spoke to Chris Taylor, the test pilot. He used to be a test pilot for the CAA a few years back, and he has some very interesting stories about flying gyrocopters. So, I'm hoping that all your carefulness and mindfulness about safety is in hand, because they sound horrific.
Well, I got into a little bit of trouble with the gyrocopter community because I said on one of our Flyer Aero Friedrich Schaven videos that I would take some convincing that they weren't the worst of both worlds. So I think I think someone from the gyrocopter world was a bit indignant about that, and I think they're hoping to change my mind on that one. So, which would be interesting, to see what that's going to be like. But, you know, Amelia Earhart used to fly gyrocopters. I didn't even realize that they were invented that far back, but apparently so.
Wow. And I suppose cost aside, because this is a cost-loaded question, what about twin-engined fixed wing and twin-engined rotary wing flying?
Yeah, on the rotary front, completely unaffordable unless you're doing a commercial license. It would be probably about 1200 quid an hour. You know, it's something that you just don't do unless you're getting the type rating getting the type rating for a commercial job. And in terms of twin engine fixed wing, it's not something that I'm planning on going into, again for cost reasons, but just I don't really need to be honest. I don't intend to go commercial. I like having it just as a hobby, and also just in terms of the availability of those aircraft to hire, because any UK flying club will have lots of PA-28s and 172s to hire, you're not going to really find a twin engine aircraft to hire unless you're at one of the commercial schools, again training airline pilots. So it's not really something that is on my radar as a pilot.
Okay. So we're into spring. Mm. Started to see the first of Rachel's pictures appearing on social media. Have you got any exciting plans for this summer?
Again, Take Flight has a few interesting flyouts planned. I think we're going to do the usual 2K1 and, of course, the Shuttleworth flying proms. I think we're also planning on venturing a little bit further into France this time as well. Okay. I can't remember what the name of the airfield was, but it's quite a little bit further in inland. So that'll be an interesting adventure if the weather doesn't scupper our plans. Quite like to get down to the Isles of Scilly at some point. Because I've still not done that trip.
Is that a fixed wing or a rotary?
Fixed wing, yeah. Right. You can land on St. Mary's. So, although I do know someone, I think, who managed to land on the Tresco helipad in a fixed wing.
Right, okay.
So it is doable if you've got a microlight or something with a very good takeoff performance. But yes, those are the main ones that spring to my mind at the moment.
And finally, one question I forgot to ask you. Is you were out in the US recently as well, weren't you?
Yes.
Flying out in the US. Tell us a little bit about that. I'd love to know what your experience is like flying in US airspace. I mean, I remember what it was like many moons ago when I flew there. It was just such utter fun. Yeah. But how did you find it?
Well, I don't have an FAA license, so obviously I'm flying with an instructor and they're doing the radio because there's no chance that I'm going to be able to decipher what the Americans are saying on the radio because they talk so fast. But I love the experience of aviation in America. They're so much more open to aviation and their airfields are amazing and it's just so much cheaper. I mean, I did an hour and an hour 44 in Boston pre-COVID, and it cost something like £200 an hour less than it would cost in the UK. And you can fly right up to the buildings in downtown Boston. You know, it's pretty amazing. But yes, my most recent trip was to Los Angeles, and I was sitting the Robinson Helicopters Pilot Safety Course, which is a 3-day course. Most of it's ground school, and then you get an hour of flying as well. And it was just so informative, so enjoyable, a little bit morbid at times because you're kind of talking about safety issues and you're sort of doing a lot of accident analysis and thinking about all the different ways there are of making yourself a better, safer pilot. So something I'd recommend to every Robinson pilot to go and do that. Of course, you get to see the factory as well, get to see the aircraft being made. And the actual flight was incredible. I was lucky enough to fly with Robinson's chief flying instructor. And we did an hour of basically emergency procedures. And we were just doing a circuit around the port of LA and just doing auto rotations into all these shipping containers. And out to sea, or not out to sea, but to the other side of the harbour wall, there were all these small fixed wing planes just obviously going and having a whale of a time, swooping low over the water. I was kind of thinking, what are they doing? What would they do right now if they had an engine failure? But it was a fantastic experience. And of course, the weather's a lot more reliable over there as well. So
it is. It very much is. It very much is. Although I flew in Florida, which suffered an awful lot of humidity, which made it quite challenging.
I did some seaplane flying in Florida.
Why did you do that? Seaplane, come on, tell us about that. What did you fly down in Florida?
That was a Cessna 182 on floats.
Yeah.
Just did basically half from one lake to another, which was a lot of fun. And I was, you know, I was a bit nervous about it. I said to the instructor, I think you'd better do the landing. He's like, no, you're going to do it. And it was great. And then toward the end of the flight, he said, let's go and have some fun. And he just took us down really low over the swamps and just swooped around and, you know, looking for alligators and things. It was great.
Wow. Well, if you haven't heard enough from Rachel about what a fabulous GA experience you can have in the UK, then go over to follow her on social media and her blog. Rachel, where can we find you online on social media and the blog?
Yeah, well, Twitter and Instagram, it's at Ms. Rachel Ramsey. And then my blog is rachelramsey.substack.com.
Substack.com. Okay, I'll put links to those in the show.
And be sure to subscribe. Rachel, be sure to subscribe to my Substack because it's free. There's no paywall.
Okay. Well, That's not the link I had, so I'm going to have to check that one out. But I'll do that afterwards, and we'll put those links in the show notes. Also, Flyer magazine. Where can we find you on Flyer magazine?
Yeah, go to flyer.co.uk, and my column is called Whirly Bird. But there's also lots of other great content on there about all forms of aviation, so, and lots of video content as well.
Wonderful, wonderful. Rachel, really enjoyed that. Thanks so
much.
Thank
you very much for having me.
So we'd like to thank White Hearts as well as the wider extended family of supporters, including Mick Oakey at the Aviation Historian and Simon Jakubowski at the Aviation Enthusiasts Book Club. We know you're busy, but thousands of you listening, and we'd love to get your feedback either on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or on your podcast player. Do stay engaged with us. You can find me and Ascot Hornet on Twitter, and you can find Ellie, Gareth and Tim on the extended Twitter, Facebook and Instagram feeds. That's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from Rachel.
Hi.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. And remember to stay tuned into this frequency, and thank you for listening to Extended. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons licence.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our programme and broaden its reach. You can also review the programme and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Extend it!
This is XTP Media.